Welcome, everybody. You are listening to Note Coast Cinema here on WGN Plus. We are your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago and all around the world. I am your host, Tom Hush, and joining me, as always, is my beautiful co-host, Connor Cornelius, vibrant as ever.
Hi, I'm Tom, Connor. Glad to be back. Thank you, Tom.
It's been a rough morning.
I'm blushing.
I know. I tend to do that to people. I really flatter them to the point of delirium.
And I know. The listeners, they can only hear your voice, but having to listen and see, it's and getting complimented at the same time, it's a task.
It's overwhelming.
Absolutely.
For this episode of No Coast, we decided that we need to bring back one of our favorite guests. His name is John Davies. He is the creator, operator, and mastermind behind Cinema Obscura, which is a screening event that goes on every single Monday at Township. And he's showing off the best of Chicago cinema, some of the weirdest, best, craziest
original filmmaking,
most original filmmaking that's happening, and he's doing it every week, and we admire him so much for it. Welcome back to the program, John Davies.
Oh, thank you guys for having me again. This is amazing.
Oh, seriously. We are so happy. We can't talk enough about Cinema Obscura, and it seems like every time we meet someone new on the show, we're like, "Do you know John Davies?" Like, yeah, of course
you
know
John Davies. Like, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Seriously.
How is Cinema Obscura going? By the way,
it's going very well, very very well. We're booked through the end of August.
Oh, wow.
Nice.
2 weeks off, then we're coming back, and we're booked to the end of October. And then I got to start thinking about the rest of the year. So we're looking pretty good.
That is strong.
Nice. Yeah.
That is strong. And it's got to be a good feeling to know that you've got all this programming coming forward, and you can just focus on the promotion and all that kind of stuff. And we're definitely going to check in with you later and see what's coming up, what's on that schedule for Cinema Obscura. But for right now, we got to do our new segment.
Yes.
And
not the new segment, the news segment.
It's coming soon here on No Coast Cinema right now.
Yeah.
It's the news coming soon. Coming soon to a theater near you.
Oh, yeah.
Come on now. Gonna talk about what's going on. What's going on.
Yeah.
And that is our theme for the news segment. Recorded last week with Nate Waters.
Completely improvisation.
Yes.
Your complete improvisation.
Yeah, we're super proud of that one. I can't believe it.
I like it.
Honestly.
Yeah.
But what we're going to start off with here is a little film, an indie film.
Yeah, by a little known Chris.
Yeah, his name's Chris Nolan,
I think. Yeah.
He's British. Mm-hmm. He is white, and he has blonde hair. He did some smaller films.
Some sort of auteur film work.
A crime movie called The Dark Knight, I think.
Yeah. It's about like a guy that runs around dressed up as a vulture or something.
Yeah.
Noir classic.
And all irony and postmodernism aside, we're talking about Dunkirk, directed by Chris Nolan. Just came out. And it's been getting great reviews. People are really loving it. We can only assume that's going to be up for some sort of awards when it comes awards time. Considered one of the best of his filmography. However, it's not without a problem, and that has to do with representation and diversity. And before you get on us calling us snowflakes, PC police, this is about historical accuracy right here. So there has been some debate in India over the film. Now, the film is getting great reception in India.
Near unanimous critical acclaim.
Exactly. All around the world, especially in India. However, they do have a bone to pick with the representation of Indian soldiers at Dunkirk, or rather, the lack thereof. They are complaining that at the time, at the Battle of Dunkirk, there were lots of Indian soldiers who were fighting on behalf of the British Empire. According to India Today, they pointed out that about 1,800 Indian soldiers were tasked with transporting 2,000 mules carrying arms and ammunition to the war zone in France. Now, that is a pretty serious number of people to be at the Battle of Dunkirk.
And to be noticeably absent from the film entirely.
Absolutely. And I think this is an interesting point about historic, not just representation, which is important. We've talked about that many times on the show, but also historical accuracy in favor of a particular narrative. John, how do you, when you hear this, have you seen Dunkirk?
I have not seen it yet.
Not seen it yet. Mm-hmm. And I myself have not seen it up to this point. Because we're waiting for the 70mm. Mm-hmm. We really want to see it in 70mm. We're going to wait for that. But that aside, when you hear something like this coming out of a big movie, like, what are your thoughts? You know, why can't we get historical representation right?
I think it's filming and writing from, unfortunately, a white perspective. You know, we just leave things out, important things, way too often, and that's kind of disheartening. You know, I don't think Christopher Nolan did it on purpose.
No, I don't think so either. He doesn't strike me as a malicious guy.
No.
But he talked all this game about, oh, I did all this research on the Battle of Dunkirk. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. I know everything about Dunkirk. I'm going to make this movie. It's going to be my war epic. And he just kind of glosses over the details in favor of a white narrative.
I've been reading a lot of reviews about it, and they're all saying, amidst all of the, you know, compliments and stuff towards Nolan, they say that he sort of got swept away by the story. And a lot of the angles of these articles are saying that in a positive light. But for a guy that, like you said, John, if he's writing it just from a white perspective, he got swept away by a maybe like a singular sort of a remote viewpoint of the story of how it actually happened.
Mm-hmm. And I think something to be said is the story of Dunkirk to us here in the States, maybe not a lot of people know it, and people know of it, and they're just like, oh, this is, you know, a historical event, something that happened at the outbreak of World War II. But in the United Kingdom and, you know, just the British Empire in general, the Battle of Dunkirk is really a defining moment. Mm-hmm. I would almost, and, you know, you can grill me for this if you want, I'd be willing to compare it to something like D-Day in terms of its, like, mythology of the way that people talk about what happened on that day. Mm-hmm. And how important it was in retrospect. You know, at the time, this is a more or less a defeat of sorts. It's a retreat. It's an evacuation. They need to go. Luckily, they saved hundreds of thousands of lives, and it's a success in that sense. But at the time, it was only that. It was an evacuation. But looking back at it, it more or less saved the Allies. You know, that could have really spelled pretty big trouble for the Allies during World War II. And Dunkirk is a critical moment in that World War II narrative.
Yeah.
But as we're talking about narratives, it is that white narrative. You know, when you watch Saving Private Ryan, I don't really remember any black soldiers.
Well, yeah.
I don't really remember a lot of black soldiers.
Tom Hanks and Matt Damon. And
yeah. Mm-hmm. And not that there's anything wrong with having those people be in the movie. Having white people in a movie is not like a sin. But let's be honest with ourselves here. You know, you can't just go from the white narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that continues to happen. Again, I don't think maliciously.
No.
But it's still ignorance. And right. Ignorance doesn't necessarily need to be tolerated, especially in big movies like Dunkirk.
Yeah, for a movie that's being lauded for the things that it, the strength that, of the things that it does show people, as well as the things that it doesn't show. Winston Churchill is noticeably absent for it, for a battle that he was very vocal about, and he is remembered in his legacy for having spun it around to be sort of like a moral victory for England at the time. But obviously, we need to be also critical about the things that he left out, seemingly unintentionally.
Mm-hmm. All right. Moving on, we're getting a story here from Variety, fantastic publication that we use for a lot of stories.
Thank you, Variety.
Thanks, Variety. We didn't really ask. We just simply took. but we will credit you here because that is the right thing to do. According to Variety, Lionsgate CEO John Feltheimer has gotten his compensation bumped up a little bit, about
if you
triple.
If you didn't think he was making enough,
yeah,
he definitely is now.
Yes. His compensation package has been tripled to $35.3 million.
Mm.
That's
cool.
More money than I've ever even thought of in my entire life. That includes a $1.5 million salary, $5.4 million in stock awards, $16.3 million in option awards, $12 million in non-equity incentives, and about $150,000 in other compensation. God knows what that is.
And then didn't another one of his teammates, they also doubled their right. salary as well. And what is the reason for this? Is this because of their acquisition of Stars?
He agreed to, so he announced in October that he agreed to a 5-year extension of his contract, and that was 2 months before Lionsgate's $4.4 billion acquisition of premium cable network Stars.
Right.
And so I guess they're just provisions of the deal that he made, you know, a $5 million bonus if Lionsgate met performance goals within 3 months of achieve. It's at this point, it just devolves into numbers.
Right.
And which is important in this story. You know, it's numbers is a big thing in Hollywood, as we all know. There's a lot of money. Let us not pretend, and I think John, you even said this last time you were here, that it's an industry, it's mm-hmm. a business.
Absolutely.
There it is,
and
it
there is a
capital,
bottom line.
Yeah, there's mm-hmm. a bottom line, and it is capitalism at its most awesome in its splendor. Mm-hmm. I guess I hesitate to use splendor because it is also
in
fearsome.
Its spectacle. Yeah,
yeah,
sure.
In its spectacle.
It's American splendor.
Exactly. The amount of money being thrown around. And just to let you know, this figure was disclosed as part of the company's proxy statement, which was filed on Friday with the SEC. And what I want to know is, how and why are these CEOs getting doled out these massive paychecks? Because is it really the amount of money that's being brought in? Because we know that theater attendance is down. Mm-hmm. We know that the industry is not making nearly as much money as they want to be making, especially with the price tags of these franchises, of these massive movies that they are just pushing. They're pushing all their chips in mm-hmm. on. How are these still getting these massive payouts?
I think the reason behind, I don't know why his salary was tripled, but I think that they said along with this acquisition of Stars in an industry that is sort of shrinking a little bit, they doubled their business mm-hmm. over the last year. So obviously it makes sense that he would be making more money and that the people around him would be getting that as well. Mm-hmm. But it definitely seems exorbitant that his already $12 million
his salary, his base salary is $1.5 million, and then they just pile on stock options, stock awards, other non-equity incentives, which, dear listeners, I will disclose to you, I have no idea what the hell that is, but it's clearly income for him. John, you're coming from cinema from a very grassroots point of view, mm-hmm. and a point of view that I think here at No Coast we believe in. And how does it make you feel to see these companies just writing bigger paychecks to these guys?
I think it's fairly insane, especially in the movie market these days. Mm-hmm. You're looking at a lot of remakes coming out, a lot of stuff that's been written, and the story's been out there for, say, 40 years already. And to pay somebody this much to get these remakes remade and remade and remade is insane to me. There's not a lot of new material out there, so where is this coming from? It's mind-blowing.
Yeah, what's the value, you know?
Mm-hmm. Where is the money coming? I mean, there's plenty of investment, and especially, as you mentioned, Connor, with the acquisition of Stars, that's big business, because the home media market, especially with Stars, has their own streaming service, mm-hmm. a la, you know, Showtime, HBO Go. They have all that going on. Stars has their own service. They recently had a pretty big critical hit with American Gods.
Mm-hmm.
And they also have Ash versus Evil Dead, which is, you know, tapping into all of our collective cult mm-hmm. nostalgia, which I've never actually seen the show. I don't know if it's any good, but they've got Bruce Campbell back.
Yeah, a little bit of it I've seen, and it's good.
It's good.
It's good.
It's also spawned a bunch of lookalike series, I guess.
Yeah, mm-hmm. like Stan versus Evil.
Stan versus Evil.
Starring Dr. Cox from Scrubs.
What?
Yeah, that's the show I watched. That's,
yeah.
Oh, I didn't watch it. I watched an episode.
An episode. Anyway. Mm-hmm. So I guess maybe if this was his idea, he should be rewarded for being smart enough to get into that market. But at the same time, $35 million? You know, why can't you invest that in some mid-budget films
yeah.
that could do really well? You know, Lionsgate, they're not like the biggest studio in the world, but they make a lot of movies. They do well for themselves all across the market, whether it's horror, they do drama, they do comedy, they do everything. So why not just take some money and invest in smaller films that can yield a bigger reward? We've seen a lot of films as of late that have those kind of mid-budget, especially stuff from like Blumhouse, you know, doing horror, those mid-budget films that can show massive returns. So just from the perspective of an executive, you know, I would, what does someone even do with $35 million?
I don't know. They just piss it away. Hopefully not.
God.
If he's just going to use it to reinvest in the rebooting of the Hunger Games franchise, fine.
Already.
Fine. That's what we're looking at right now.
I need it.
Reboot this, reboot that.
Yeah, reboot. Oh,
you know, don't
gosh.
Write anything new. Just
God forbid.
Yeah, because even if it's like a $50 million budget, you're still going to make, you know, $150 million internationally, right?
Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm. Why not?
It's just a safe investment.
Now, speaking of streaming, Connor brought me this story because he is the king of finding internet. He's really tapped into international cinema and international cinema business, and he brought me this story, and I love this. Connor, give me a little primer.
So if you guys got your globes out, you want to go to the little island nation, Japan. Japanese e-commerce giant called Rakuten. They recently rebranded their streaming service, which is called Wuwaki, which is... up until this point has typically been a rental and purchased based service. But now they've setting their sights on taking on the titans of streaming like Netflix and Amazon through the creation of their own original television shows and movies. And for people unfamiliar with Rakuten, probably haven't heard of it that much in the U.S., it is only really available in 12 European countries as well as Japan. But they're starting to engage in more international markets, obviously, through this next step. They're definitely taking a couple of plays from the big streaming, you know, people's, the big streaming companies' playbooks. They're trying to engage TV and film producers with kind of a limited distribution reach and giving them access to this baker's dozen of international markets that they have access to. And it was interesting, the CEO and founder of Rakuten, Jacinto Roca, said that when he was asked about the kind of content that people can expect to see, they kept it vague, but said that their focus is on independent, mass-market films that focus on stories that matter in order to create a platform for movie producers with that limited distribution. Mm-hmm. And obviously, they've got a long road ahead of them, but if Netflix and Amazon are any indication of how successful something like that can be, especially since Rakuten intends to actually have a theatrical release for their films and for their TV shows, it's going to be a bit before we see this content materialize, but wishing the best of luck.
Absolutely. And it's nice to see that an international company like Rakuten is taking cues there, because it seems like this is the way to go. Obviously, it's worked out astoundingly well for Amazon Studios. They are winning Oscars.
Yeah.
Their films are Manchester by the Sea, great film, one of the standouts of 2016, and there's really only more coming from there. And you know, we talked a little bit last week about Chris Nolan's aversion to the model that Netflix has, but he does appreciate Amazon, where they do kind of the 90-day release window, where it comes out in theaters, they let it do its run in theaters, and then bring it straight to the service. But this idea of original content straight to streaming, and that being the new method, John, you know, you are a purveyor of original film and original ideas. Mm-hmm. Is this maybe the way people need to go to get around the studios and their kind of limited view of how movies can be released?
I think it can be. I think Netflix and Hulu have shown you that you can go around studios, you can get stuff done, and you can get quality stuff done without going through studios and red tape and all that. Just make it and, you know, film it and air it. That's the shortcuts right there. You know, don't give it to the guy that's making $35 million.
Yeah.
Or whatever we just talked about. It's still boggling me. Mm. We don't need – I mean, not – I shouldn't say we don't. Not everybody needs the corporate –
right.
Hand out the corporate help.
And millions of people use these streaming services. Mm-hmm. I mean, I use like three streaming. I have Netflix, I have Amazon Prime, I have Hulu, and I have Filmstruck, which is, you know, for really pretentious idiots like myself. I pay $10 a month so I can watch the Criterion Collection and feel superior to others. Mm-hmm. But I am definitely pro going to the movies. If I can see a movie in cinemas, before it comes to streaming, I want to do that first. That is my first thing. However, you can't see every movie.
These streaming giants are giving creative control to, you know, film producers and film creators and giving them these huge distribution deals akin to what big studios would, you know, historically have given them.
Yeah.
But they get to maintain their vision, and it's a great new sort of advent for the art form.
Absolutely. And The Big Sick, a film that I have not gotten to see in theaters, I would like to see in theaters first, is produced by Amazon Studios. So I know that if I can't get into the theater because I'm too busy with work or too busy doing whatever, I can at least see it at some point. And I know that the people who have made the film, they are being compensated because Amazon pretty much just has all the money in the world to throw around. They bought Whole Foods on a whim. Why not make a few movies? Jeff Bezos literally operates the Washington Post as like a side hobby, you know? So there's a bright side to this kind of massive corporate entity, is that on one end, they have, you know, they own everything and are in your house listening to you do whatever you do, you know, cook food and like order things online. And on the other side, they're just kind of, they have this ability to be one giant patron of the arts. They're like, yeah, we don't really, like, honestly, what is it to Jeff Bezos if The Big Sick doesn't turn a massive profit? He's like, I don't really give a shit. Like,
he was the richest man in the world for a few hours the other day.
Yeah, he had beat out Bill Gates
for a few hours.
For a few hours. Wait, did Bill Gates come back?
Yeah, so I saw an article and it was
like, out.
Jeff Bezos is now the richest man in the world, and then like at like 8 p.m. or something, Bill Gates had overtaken him, and people were just like, for a few hours, Jeff Bezos was on top.
And then it came crashing
and
then down.
It all came crashing down.
Kind of love that.
Yeah.
Would you ever set, I know Amazon has like channels, like what if you did like a Cinema Obscura channel?
I would love that. I would love something like that. Yeah. Not for me,
not
but for
you.
My filmmakers. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm hopefully a stepping stone to get them in that arena.
Realm.
Yeah, totally.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Jeff Bezos.
Yeah. Come on,
go on the show.
Go on the show.
We got a pitch for you. I want you to meet my boy John Davies. He's about to blow your melon. He's going to change your life.
Nobody's doing what he's doing.
All right. Finally, I do have to bring this up because this is just the thing of the moment.
It's a dark light at the end of this tunnel.
Usually it's the other way. Usually you're going from a dark tunnel into the white light. No, we're reaching mass capitalism here. True capitalism.
Critical mass capitalism.
Critical mass capitalism. This week saw the release of the Emoji Movie, a film based on those little symbols that you send to people on your phones to represent a variety of emotions such as happiness, sadness, and sexual confusion.
Because what better way to communicate your feelings than through homogenized images, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So they decided, Sony, who has not been doing so great financially in recent years, decided that in order to get out of this hole, they need to make a movie based on emojis, giving us the Emoji Movie starring TJ Miller, also of Silicon Valley, in the artistic role of his life, you know, playing the meh emoji. How would you say that? Meh?
Meh.
Meh.
Yeah.
But he plays an emoji that has the uncanny ability to feel multiple emotions at the same time.
What's
and
that like?
I could not tell you. I wish I knew what it meant to feel emotions.
One emotion at a time, please.
Yes, only one. And as you might expect, it is being critically panned. It has a 6% on Rotten Tomatoes. Although 48% of audiences liked it,
which
all
is
right.
kind of amazing.
Yeah.
For a movie it's a kid's movie, you know?
Yeah.
I feel like that rating would be higher if the movie was good. Or if the movie, you know, was like watchable.
Yeah. Well, I mean, maybe for the kids, I'm sure it's completely watchable.
Yeah.
It's just bright colors. And that's not to say that kids are dumb, because I don't believe that. I believe that kids are, you know, that children have the ability to understand complex emotions, mm-hmm. and watch things like Hayao Miyazaki's movies and enjoy them just as much. They don't need to be pandered to. And yet here we are with the Emoji Movie, and Patrick Stewart is playing the poop emoji.
And the role of his life.
The role of his career.
Yeah.
The storied career of Patrick Stewart, Sir Patrick Stewart.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of wanted to bring up some of my favorite sort of reviews on this. I just want to let people know who is in this movie. People like TJ Miller, Maya Rudolph, James Corden of late night fame, Anna Faris of Scary Movie fame, Jennifer Coolidge, and disappointingly enough, Stephen Wright.
Wow.
I understand why they picked him, because he's got the most bland sounding voice in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Super Sounds of the 70s, you know.
Mm.
If y'all remember, he was the radio announcer. Yeah, the radio announcer from Reservoir Dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And also a comedian in his own right. But kind of disappointing to see all these great people just cashing their checks and being like, well, we're gonna make a shit ton of money off of this movie.
And they did say, the director of that movie just said, the studio knows that we're down to get paid globally.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. This movie, I mean, the box office, the numbers aren't all together yet. They're doing, you know, rolling reports, but usually I like to wait and see what the finalized numbers are. But as far as I know, it's doing really well. As some listeners might know or remember, I work in a movie theater, and tons of people coming, bringing their kids, sneaking in Bush Light because they can't handle, like, the oppressive horror that is the Emoji Movie.
That is ridiculous.
And their beer of choice is Bush Light. So
yeah, no.
To give you an idea of the oppressive horror,
yeah,
they're dealing with.
Wow. I would have at least given them an ice house, because it's just like, if you're going to go for it, you might as well go for
yeah,
it.
Yeah, get
like,
those ABVs in. So,
yeah.
Tom, what does this mean for, I want to say humanity in general, but I feel like it's a little bit more centralized. What does this mean for the United States?
For the United States? The Emoji Movie. Oh, it's not good. I think John has a better perspective. He's got the apocalypse forecast.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Emoji Movie is just akin to the end, you know. Pretty sure the same thing that took out the Egyptians with the hieroglyphics movie. That got them. This is going to get us. We are done for.
Yes. Yes.
History
repeats itself. And, I mean, the critics are more or less saying the same thing. Johnny Oleksinski from the New York Post, very funny writer, said, "Hear that? It's the end of the world."
Yep.
Caitlin Tiffany and Lizzie Plowjick from The Verge, "I don't think I can say anything funny about this because it makes me want to die."
Jesus. Even the positive reviews are like, it says meh in the positive review. How
yeah.
is that even?
Betsy Bozdek from Common Sense Media, the name in Common Sense Media, positive messages, but colorful adventure is only meh.
And yeah. Patrick Stewart, did they trick you?
Yeah.
Did they trick you to do this movie? I am so sorry.
I've done voiceover
acting before. You're fantastic at it, and they must have tricked you. I don't know what happened.
Maybe he just thought it was going to be fun or something. I don't know.
God.
This is a surprisingly high-minded review from, not surprisingly, but like RogerEbert.com said, "A demonstration of artistic abdication at its most venal. But will the kids like it?"
That's a bunch of words strung together that make no sense.
Yeah, that sounds like The New Yorker almost.
Mm-hmm. It's
like,
exactly the kind of people mm-hmm. who are pissed off about the Emoji Movie. They want to see that.
Yeah.
So venal and so vapid and mm-hmm. Obsequious.
I don't think that's a word. Oh, my
that's a
gosh.
Word.
So,
it's a word, but I don't know if it's...
Yeah. If you, if you have watched the Emoji Movie, please go on Facebook, NoCo Cinema Podcast, and tell us what you thought.
An honest review.
Honestly.
In emojis.
Yeah, in emojis. In emojis. But honestly, if you liked it, please tell us, because we have not seen it. I don't really want to see it. I'd rather, but if someone says, if we have to, we'll do it. But if someone could just, if you want to make a case for the Emoji Movie about how it's actually like a subversion of, you know, postmodernist filmmaking and a return to sincerity, I'd love to hear it, because I need to know.
Coders can code.
Coders can code. All right. So next up, we're going to have a discussion here about cult movies and cult cinema, and that's going to be part of our feature presentation. We've got John Davies here from Cinema Obscura sticking around to talk a little cult movies with us. And, of course, Connor will hopefully return. He might go see the Emoji Movie in the break and then come back, but I can't promise anything.
How do you know I'm on Fandango right now?
I can see things.
Ooh.
Ooh. We'll be right back here on NoCo Cinema here on WGN Plus.
I did not hit her. It's not true. It's bullshit. I did not hit her. I did not. Oh, hi, Mark.
All right. You're listening to NoCo Cinema here on WGN Plus. We are your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago and all around the world. I am your host, Tom Hush. And we're listening to some clips of clips of The Room.
Hi, Johnny. I didn't know it was you. Here you go.
That's me. How much is it?
It'll be $18.
Here you go. Keep the change. Hi, doggy.
You're my favorite customer.
There you go.
That is a clip from The Room and the previous one as well. Clips from The Room, possibly one of the greatest cult films ever made. In case I didn't get to it, I'm your host, Tom Hush, and I am joined by my beautiful co-host, Connor Cornelius, who is my best friend, my worst enemy, and
everything in between?
Yeah, everything in between, which involves a lot of different things, if we're being honest.
Well, thank you, Tom.
And today, if you've been listening, we're joined by John Davies. He is the creator, operator, and mastermind behind Cinema Obscura, which is a weekly screening series over at Township. And every week he's showing up the best of Chicago independent cinema, all the cult, indie, fun, weird stuff that's happening in this beautiful city. Thank you so much for coming back, John.
Thank you guys for having me again. I really appreciate it.
Now, since we have John here, I figured that we needed to talk about one of my favorite topics in movies, which is cult cinema. As many of you know, there is a new film coming out based on a book called The Disaster Artist. And The Disaster Artist is the chronicle of the making of The Room, which is widely considered to be one of the best, worst movies ever made. The book is written by Greg Sestero, who plays Mark in The Room. And the film version is starring James Franco, Dave Franco, and Seth Rogen as well.
The Apatow crew.
Exactly. The Apatow crowd, being released by currently hot production company A24, which has done films such as It Comes at Night and Moonlight, but they're getting into this weird Apatow world, and they're talking about this cult movie. And with that in mind, I want to get into a little discussion about cult movies. What is a cult film? How does something become a cult film? Can you just make a movie that is intentionally cult? And let's go around the board here a little bit. John, what in your mind is a cult film?
I think cult film is something that fails at the box office but just explodes with fandom. I think that's what it boils down to, really. You know, it just doesn't do well for the production company, doesn't do well for the guy that is making $35 million, but the fans love it and just love it and watch it and memorize it and becomes not only part of your culture but becomes part of you. You know, you just become that movie.
And is the lack of critical success something that film's following, that is, it's almost maybe a reason why they like it so much?
I think it helps definitely.
Yeah,
if you're successful in the movie theater, I think it'd be very hard to become a cult or a cult status film. Mm-hmm. That being said, there are movies out there that are huge and that are cult, Alien franchise, Star Wars franchise.
Sure.
Not as cult as what we're talking about with The Room and, say, Night of the Comet and the other weird movies that we grew up with.
Plan 9 from Outer Space, yeah. By Ed Wood. I think that is an interesting distinction that mm-hmm. I think needs to be brought up, and we'll get into that a little bit, because cult can be a movie, like, I want to get over here to our Facebook. We threw up a post on Facebook saying we were talking about cult movies, and we asked people, can you define for us what is a cult movie, and what are some of your favorite cult movies? And listener Caleb, he said, pretty much what you said, John. Upon release, it was critically and financially a failure, mm-hmm. too obscure, but after a while, i.e. through home release or syndication, it finds its audience, yeah. Which is important. And I think that is the most pure idea of what a cult film is. But I do like this idea that you can have a big film that is super successful that still is a cult film in the sense that a cult has formed around it. Mm-hmm. I would be inclined to say one of my favorites of that ilk, and I'm not sure where it falls, is Mean Girls. And okay. That is 100% one of the funniest movies I've ever seen. No one can really argue with me on that, I don't think. But as far as I know, when I was growing up, it was a fairly popular film. People mm-hmm. liked Mean Girls. It was, you know, it had Lindsay Lohan in it. Mm-hmm. You know, people knew what it was and were quoting it all the time. But it has a serious cult of personality around it because, like I said, people can quote that entire movie through and through, and they are obsessed with it.
Yeah, yeah.
So I want to know, what are some of your favorite movies that would be considered cult films, John?
I mentioned one at the top, Night of the Comet. That's one of my favorite all-time sleepover classic movies.
What is that one about?
Oh, it's about the end of the world. It's fantastic. teenagers basically are left with the mess. Actually, they're left with no mess. Everybody's gone but them. It's kind of fantastic. And
really?
There's zombies in it. There's a dude from Star Trek in it. It's good. I don't want to give it away.
No.
Go watch it.
Go check that one out.
But yeah, Night of the Comet, sleepover staple. I can't tell you guys. If you haven't seen it, you got to watch it.
Yeah, I have not.
Adding that to the list.
Touching on the Mean Girls, I'd say Heathers.
I'm
a little bit older than you guys, so Heathers was my Mean Girls
is
when
it,
I was a kid.
It's similar. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, real similar. A lot darker. It's more of a dark comedy. But
it's got Christian Slater in it. It's got Winona Ryder.
Yep, Winona Ryder.
Mm-hmm. That is definitely one of those cult films. Connor? Some of your cult films?
We've talked about it a bunch before. I don't really want to choose one of his films, but Nicolas Cage is definitely an actor that has amassed just a cult like following around anything that he does. Mm-hmm. I think there's it's almost like a religious thing when you're a fan of a cult, of any sort of like a cult film scene, you know? But I will say the only time I've ever done this, I paid $10 to see Nicolas Cage's movie, where he's playing the white ghost. It's got Hayden Christensen in it. I can't remember what it's called. But I paid $10 to see it ahead of its theatrical release or whatever. And it was bad, but I had a great time. Like you said, it's like a good, lame sleepover movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think, because so much of what we think of when we think of cult movies is that they have to be good, bad, mm-hmm. you know, so bizarre, so out there, or just something. I think a large part of it has to do with intended effect and then actual effect.
There's a group out of Canada doing just that.
Yeah.
The Astron 6 group.
They
made Manborg, Father's Day, The Editor.
I think I've heard of Manborg.
They are ridiculous. It's trauma-esque. I'm not going to say it's trauma, but it's trauma-esque. Mm-hmm. Fantastically ridiculous. Maybe making movies just to make cult movies. I don't know what they're doing, mm-hmm. but everything that they've made has been not critically acclaimed. It doesn't really have a cult following yet, but once people become aware of it, maybe from the show, I don't know, those guys will be on this list next time we talk about this.
Astron 6?
Yeah, Astron 6. They do some really good stuff out of Canada. They're amazing.
Now, can someone make a cult film intentionally?
Yeah, that's a good question. Because, isn't, like you said, it's actual versus intended effect.
Right.
Even if a movie takes itself seriously, for a movie to be a cult movie, you kind of have to be able to laugh with it, mm-hmm. have fun with it, maybe laugh at it.
Sure. I think you can. There's movies out there like these guys I'm talking about. There's a movie, Black Dynamite, that came out a few years ago.
Okay, right. Yeah, for sure.
It is, does have a cult around it.
Yeah, I highly doubt that was critically acclaimed. You know, it's ridiculously stupid, but, you know, we love it.
But I think with Black Dynamite and a close cousin of it, Undercover Brother, like, I think those might fall into the category of just, like, not necessarily, they weren't super financially, like, well received critically. I think there are big fans of, there are people that really love Black Dynamite and really love Undercover Brother especially. And I think those fall into, it was, maybe they weren't looking to do a cult film. Maybe they were making, movies about what were cult movies, because that's like, those two are definitely beautiful homages to the blaxploitation genre.
Yeah.
And if a cult, like, maybe the cult was already there, people who looked at blaxploitation and said, wait a minute, there's something here other than just, like, you know, guns and, you know, and black people being represented in a certain way. There's, like, an empowerment here. And there's some people that read it that way, some people that don't. But when I think of movies that try really hard to be cult movies, I can't help but think of, like, Sharknado, like the Sharknado series.
Okay.
Or a lot of things that sci-fi does, like those really cheap monster flicks. I think at one point they were just like, let's just make a monster movie. Like, but then people started, the cult thing kind of came back, and people were really into kitsch and cheese and sleaze, and so
silliness. Ian Ziering,
yeah, exactly. And so you get Sharknado, which is at this point trying so hard to be like, oh, it's so bad, it's good.
It's,
you know,
on its fifth installment now.
Yeah, global swarming.
Yeah.
Yeah, when I saw part five, I was surprised. Last one I saw was three. I thought they were done. And
yeah, I didn't know they were
just when you think they're done.
They're not going to be done
ever. The shark infested tornado is back.
Yeah. And the first one had that level of kitsch. And had that right kind of mix, and I think it worked. Otherwise, they wouldn't have made another four of them, you know. But now it's just getting tired, and it seems like they're trying so hard. And it brings me back, desired effect or intended effect versus actual effect. The Room, which by some is considered to be the cult movie, is supposed to be a drama, like a pretty serious drama at that. We've all seen The Room, correct?
Yeah.
And
love triangle.
Yeah, love triangles, cancer, drug dealing. What? And you've just got these ridiculous performances.
Well, there's no acting in that movie. It's just lines being read. That's it.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic. I'm not knocking it. It's great.
It's got the it went the way of Rocky Horror, which is another cult film. And it does the whole midnight circuit thing. So
I've never attended a screening of The Room, but I've just read articles about the community and the sort of the rites that get carried out at each screening for people that are familiar with it. And that, it just amazed, like, I really want to go see. I know that they show it at the Music Box a couple times, at least a couple times a year. I really want to go make it out to one of those.
Especially because usually they're like, Tommy Wiseau might come. I think there was at least one time where he was scheduled to come, and they're like, no, he's going to be there. I swear to God, he's going to be there. And then he didn't come. I wonder how he feels about it.
In character, all the time.
Yeah. I've seen interviews with him. He thinks that it's a really good movie.
He still does.
Yeah,
he does.
I've actually also heard rumors that he didn't direct it.
Yeah? Was it Steven Spielberg?
Sort of. Yeah, I've actually heard that Steven Spielberg directed it.
That makes so much sense.
He did Poltergeist, and then he did The Room. I've got I've got a good list here, and this is a reader's poll in Rolling Stone for the 25 best cult movies of all time. I'm just going to kind of quickly go through a few of them, and please feel free to stop me when we hit something. I mean, right off the bat, number 25 is Army of Darkness.
It's huge.
Yeah, huge. And that's a cult where it's like, again, that's not a good bad movie. That's just a good movie. Yeah. Army of Darkness is exactly what Sam Raimi wanted, more or less. Like, it's a horror comedy, and it's just got a good cult around it because people love the Evil Dead series.
Much better produced than the first two. It's visually more appealing. They're not locked in a cabin the whole time.
No.
Stuff happens.
Yeah, and you get great lines like, "This is my boomstick."
Yeah. It's fantastic.
The Princess Bride is on here, number 23.
That could have not been critically panned. That's like one of the most beloved movies of all time, right?
Well, maybe that's something that not panned, but like it could just been it could be lukewarm.
Yeah, okay, sure.
It wasn't though. It's directed by Rob Reiner. Like,
yeah.
I'm going to say this right now. I'm not going to take the time to go look up all the reviews of The Princess Bride at the time.
Of course.
But I think that falls into that Mean Girls category of a movie that was well received at the time and just is so beloved. Like, it has a cult following around it. People who know it line by line, bit by bit. And it still is a cult movie to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. I've got one that was actually mentioned on Facebook here by one of our listeners and also one of our guests, Mr. Nate Waters. Mm-hmm. He wanted to chime in for sure. And he said The Room, he said Rocky Horror Picture Show, and then Repo, the Genetic Opera, what a bizarre movie.
I have not seen that one yet.
It is. I remember I watched the trailer when I was a kid when it came out. I was like, what the hell is this? Mm-hmm. And then I watched it and I was like, what the hell is this? It was still really cool, though. I enjoyed it. The Room only comes in at 21.
Surprising.
Hedwig and the Angry Inch, which has since become a very successful Broadway production. Mm-hmm. Clerks at number 19.
A solid movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Mm-hmm. Everybody loves Clerks.
Yeah, of course.
That's a cult just from like being an indie movie, basically. Mm-hmm. It's one of those that just it got a good following.
Yeah, low budget, good dialogue, good writing.
Absolutely.
And solid characters.
Spawned the career of Kevin Smith, who has since gone on to do both good and bad things with that newfound fame. This is interesting. Number 18, Blade Runner. Now, obviously, I did not grow up in the 80s. Connor did not grow up in the 80s. John, I assume that you are a timeless being that simply came forth from the void. But but Blade Runner.
So humble about that.
That was a huge movie for me growing up.
Yeah.
Huge.
Now, did you see the original theatrical release with the like noir voiceover that they forced Harrison Ford to do?
I've seen all three versions of it. I do like the director's cut. It just gives you a little bit more of the story.
Yeah.
Without kind of like glaring over some stuff.
Sure.
You prefer it over the other two versions?
Yeah, I mean it's what his vision was all, once it's all boiled down, and that's the one I kind of stick to. The other ones are great. But, you know, the director's cut is kind of where it sticks out for me.
And Ridley Scott is really one of the people that pioneered the idea of the director's cut winding up on home media because of Blade Runner. Some people might not realize, and really when I had first heard of Blade Runner, it was only through positive talk. Mm-hmm. But at the time, Blade Runner was not a critically successful movie. It wasn't even a financially successful movie, really. It kind of, despite its eventual influence that it would have on the cyberpunk genre and just science fiction in general, Blade Runner was considered not really that big of a deal.
Yeah, people were not ready for that.
They were not ready for it. And especially because of the studio interference and meddling with the way things were working with the movie, it seems only right that it would become a cult film, especially with the introduction of the director's cut. And that really changed the movie for a lot of people. I know that it changed the way that it looked in film history. And now it is just like, this is top 10 best science fiction movies ever made.
And where some cult movies might not be as relevant as time goes on, Blade Runner is still an amazing movie to watch. I've only ever seen the theatrical version, and I love it. But, I mean, obviously there's more homework that I got to be doing on that.
Sure.
But,
and it's even to the point where it's getting a sequel now.
Yeah.
Like what? How many years later? 35? 40 years later?
40 years. Yeah.
It's 2049. Mm-hmm. That's what it's called, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like, so the original Blade Runner came out in 82? Let me check here real quick. It was the early 1980s that it came out. So
yeah, 1982.
Yeah, 1982. So it's getting this sequel all these years later from Denis Villeneuve, the hottest director right now, arguably. One of the
certainly
most,
for sci-fi.
Certainly for sci-fi. One of the most visually arresting, you know, he's of anybody, he's going to be the one who's going to give Blade Runner its due sequel. Cinematographer Roger Deakins, very well known for his unique visual style and incredible visuals. So it just goes to show that a movie can be poorly received and become like this critical classic. A cult movie does not need to be this good, bad sort of thing. It can just be good. Same goes for, I'm going to speed through some of these. Fight Club, big cult movie. Interestingly enough, Blues Brothers. I don't know if I would call that a cult. I thought it was, I wouldn't know, but as far as I know, it was.
It does have a huge following. I highly doubt that did well in the theaters coming out.
Yeah.
A musical based out of Chicago in the 70s.
Yeah.
It's like an SNL skit.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was an extended.
It was basically, yeah. The Warriors, which is a great movie. Walter Hill. That one is really, that is primer on cult cinema. Like, you need to watch The Warriors by Walter Hill. Absolutely. Pretty much anything by Walter Hill you need to watch. Mm-hmm. Dazed and Confused was not super well received.
That's surprising.
Yeah. It was middling. Mm-hmm. But it's one of those word of mouth movies. I love Dazed and Confused. Mm-hmm. I think it's easily one of the best movies of the 1990s.
Yeah.
Repo Man, not to be confused with Repo, the Genetic Opera, starring Emilio Estevez. Eraserhead, David Lynch. Donnie Darko, which was kind of my first introduction to cult cinema of just like, oh, what is this? Like, it's got Jake Gyllenhaal. He's a big star. Why wasn't this big? Mm-hmm. Well, because it's weird as shit.
It's really crazy.
It's crazy.
And it came out at a bad time, too.
The world was not ready
for
Donnie Darko as much as it wasn't ready for Blade Runner. Phantom of the Paradise by Brian De Palma.
Oh, so good.
A rock and roll version of Phantom of the Opera.
So
check it out. The original Evil Dead in 1981. Pink Floyd's The Wall. Harold and Maude. Definitely a cult film.
Mm-hmm. And one of my favorites of all time.
Harold and Maude. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Shout out to Hal Ashby. Hollywood did you dirty, Hal.
Mm-hmm.
God bless you. Hollywood really did you dirty. Clockwork Orange by Stanley Kubrick. Pulp Fiction is popular. This is Spinal Tap. Now,
three really good movies.
Yeah.
It's just getting better and better.
Big Lebowski, which I would say has truly the biggest cult of all cult movies, like to the point where there is Lebowski Fest.
Yeah.
That is a real thing that you can attend and go to.
How many times have you guys seen that movie, The Big Lebowski?
Oh, my God, like 50 times.
A bunch. And I still laugh every time Walter Sobchak is on screen. I'm just in love. It's so fun.
Yeah. It just blows my mind that it was poorly received when it first came out. Not poorly received, but people were just like, huh?
Yeah.
Like, the Coen brothers, who had just made Fargo, went and made arguably a stoner comedy.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, like, and it's so wacky. And, I think Connor and I have talked about this a few times, that the Coen brothers have only ever made, what was it, one type of movie, just in a multitude of different ways, which is an interesting way to look at it because it's more or less true.
I think that it's something that you could defend. And I've gotten personally attacked, verbally attacked.
Okay, not physically assaulted
on the streets, but I've been ganged up on by several people when I would, you know, I would share that opinion, and they just, you know, like Coen fanboys, they refuse to see
that every movie they've ever made is basically the same movie.
Mm-hmm.
But that is not a knock against it.
No, not at all. It's brilliant. It's how, name one person that could do that.
Yeah. Realistically, look at Fargo and look at The Big Lebowski from just like nuts and bolts perspective, and tell me how different they really are.
That's true.
Other than the tone and the characters.
Yeah.
Because that's what the Coens do. They are great at characters, and they are great at doing these crazy plots that can go super dark or super comedic.
Yeah.
Like, imagine No Country for Old Men as a comedy. Like, I mean, you probably could do it.
You got the suitcase of money. You got the ordinary people that are making bad decisions, getting caught up in all this
violence. It's Raising Arizona.
Yeah.
It's Raising Arizona. Seriously.
It's incredible.
If somebody said to me, oh, what if you made No Country for Old Men, but with Nick Cage? It's called, we made that. It's called Raising Arizona.
Yeah.
And then number one on this list is the Rocky Horror Picture Show, which may rival, I mean, maybe you could interchange Big Lebowski and Rocky Horror, but I feel like when a lot of people think of cult cinema, we're talking about Rocky Horror. Yeah. We're talking about people literally performing the movie on stage in front of the screen, putting the V's on people who are seeing it for the first time, throwing toast mm-hmm. at the screen. It is the ultimate, it is the paragon, the sort of platonic ideal of cult audience participation. And that movie sucks. Like, if you look at Rocky Horror Picture Show and not think of it as...
It's fun.
But it falls apart in the third act. Like
you got to admit that, John.
You kill Meatloaf, bad things happen.
Yeah. No, seriously, though. Like, that's the point, John. That's like when you get to... When they kill Meatloaf, when he does, like, Hoppatootie Bless My Soul, he does the song, and then they kill him with a pickaxe, the movie just... It careens off a cliff. But it is so much fun to go to a Rocky Horror screening. Yeah. I feel like it's kind of not the same sort of devotion that people had to it back in the day, because more cult movies are coming mm-hmm. to take its place. But I think the Rocky Horror Picture Show will always hold a special place in the world of cinema for
Absolutely.
Being truly bizarre mm-hmm. and a wonderful experiment. And
as far as cult status, I don't see anybody overtaken. That film, there's just no way.
Yeah, because even if it's just like, oh, but The Room, I'm like, yeah, but Rocky Horror.
Yeah, I mean, they'll try with movies like Repo.
Yeah,
you know, and
Repo basically is
goofy.
Yeah.
You know, people will try, but they won't. They won't top Rocky.
They
Horror.
Won't.
And
they
for
won't
as many people, everybody likes to go to the movie theater and have a good film going experience. You know, where maybe a crowd will laugh or whatever. But if you have not done the Rocky Horror screening, you have absolutely no idea how much of a sense of community you can mm-hmm. get from a movie that
yeah.
came out, even though it came out whatever it was 30 years ago.
It came out like 74.
40 years ago almost.
Yeah. Over 40 years ago. Just want to pull up a few suggestions from people here on Facebook. Thank you so much again, listeners, for coming on Facebook and giving us some suggestions for films. Ben from St. Louis suggested Wet Hot American Summer.
Love
so
it.
True.
Love it.
I love that movie deeply.
It's too good.
Yeah, and again, audience wasn't ready for it. Mm-mm. Those people all, pretty much everybody there went on to be a star mm-hmm. in some respect. Mm-hmm. Even people that aren't so big right, you know, anymore, like Janine Garofalo. She had a massive career, though. She
yeah.
did a lot of
she
great stuff.
She was huge at the time.
Amy Poehler.
Bradley Cooper.
That sex scene is one of the most deeply passionate things uh-huh. I've ever seen between him and Michael Ian Black.
One of the most real, and people weren't ready.
Oh,
people
no, were they were not
it
ready.
It freaked out a lot of people.
Yeah, they could not watch that representation, that accurate of a representation mm-hmm. of gay sex. Mm-hmm. So shout out to Wet Hot American Summer. I mean, I guess you could say it was played for laughs. Which, in a sense, you know, you
could
can argue
problematic.
About, yeah, it could
maybe.
Be a little problematic. But at the same time, it's there. They yeah. did it. They said, no, these two characters are gay and they're going to have sex with each other in mm-hmm. this cabin and then they're going to get married.
Yeah.
So whether or not it was played for laughs, I think there was something deeply sincere
oh,
about David
was,
Wayne
yeah. of course
actually doing it. Again, he also suggested Big Lebowski, The Room, Napoleon Dynamite.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good cult mm-hmm. film. I know I loved that so much when it came out. That was like 04, 05.
Mm-hmm.
That changed my life a lot. I've got a couple people, and they're good friends, good listeners of the show. Caleb, who I mentioned earlier, hopefully you might know some of these because he goes deep on film knowledge, Caleb.
Nice.
Mystics in Bali.
Love it. Oh, my God. That movie is crazy.
Burial Ground, Knights of Terror. And Thriller, They Call Her One Eye. But what's Mystics in Bali?
It's insane. I can't describe anything because it's all X or R-rated.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Watch it, have your mind blown, and then come back to me with big bug eyes and tell me what you thought.
Okay.
It's crazy. It's absolutely crazy.
Vampire's Kiss And that one's coming from Therese.
More Nick Cage. More Nick Cage.
Dude. Vampire's Always. Kiss.
He's a madman.
Oh, yep. My God. Especially in Vampire's Kiss. A, B, C, D, E, F. Like,
he's insane.
Whose idea was that? Whose idea was that? Mm. Reanimator. So. I love Reanimator. Mm. I'm so glad I took the time to watch that.
Goofy H.P. Lovecraft. Are you kidding me? Come on.
Oh, yeah.
Great.
Brandon said, Aguirre, The Wrath of God.
Mm-hmm.
Would you consider that a cult one? Because, I mean, it's Werner Herzog. I feel
pretty much everything he makes can be considered a cult, I would think.
There is a cult around him.
There's a cult around that guy. Yeah,
yeah, around Werner Herzog.
Mm-hmm.
And then Lise from Lise FM said Rocky Horror, yeah. Big into Rocky Horror. Mm-hmm. And then Mike as well, Fight Club. So thank you so much, guys, for commenting on that post. I've seen a lot of these. And M, a good friend of ours, M, who has had a lot of music featured on the show, said Clue.
Yeah.
Clue has a decent
I'd
cult around
yeah,
it.
For sure.
Mm-hmm. Pootie Tang.
Oh, God.
Louis C.K.'s debut?
Yeah, directorial debut.
Yeah.
Pootie Tang.
We need a sequel. Come on, Louis. Yeah. We need a sequel.
I would not be shocked.
Pootie
Tang
meets
not
Black Dynamite. We need that to happen.
Honestly. All right. So, cult cinema, there it is. We're going to be taught. I mean, if you guys have any more cult films that you need to make us aware of, please hit us up on Facebook. Mm-hmm. That's facebook.com/NoCoCinemaPodcast. Send us your favorite cult films, and we want to see them. We want to talk about them. They're fantastic. Quickly, before we get out of here, John, can you give us a preview of what's coming up this Monday? Which, if you're listening to this episode right now, that's today. That's the day this episode is released, Monday. What is coming up?
On Monday, we've got a short film, Faster, and a feature-length film, The Alley Cat, both from Marie Ulrich.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Marie. Really looking forward to them. Bicycle-related. Pretty awesome. We've got trailers up on the Facebook page. You want to come check them out? Come check them out. It's always a free show at Township here in Chicago. Always a good time. We're there every week.
Excellent. And you can find them on Facebook. Just search Cinema Obscura. That's cinema with an S. For sin. Sin.
For sex.
Cinema Obscura for sex. For
every single S word.
Yeah, for sinuses.
You
anything you could think of with an S in it. That's Cinema Obscura with an S. Yeah. Again, that is every Monday. You can find that full schedule up on Facebook. Mm-hmm. Follow John on Instagram.
Please.
He's got a great Instagram. There are so many great... You throw out some of the funniest Instagram posts I've seen.
If it amuses me, I hope it amuses you. And that's the only reason I throw it out there. Cinema Obscura on Instagram. Cinema with an S. Cinema
definitely an succeeding. S. To use another S word.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Definitely succeeding.
Oh, that's a good one.
That has been NoCo Cinema for this week. A big thank you to John, a big thank you to Connor. We will be back again next week to discuss so much film. There's so many films to watch.
Listen, there's a lot of film.
There's a lot of film.
And you got to watch it all.
Mm-hmm. Yes. We're actually going to be talking with the folks from Very Cool Videos. I'm going to be talking a little bit about their work. So if you want to get a little bit of a taste of them, head on over, search Very Cool Videos on, I believe, verycoolvideos.com.
Mm-hmm.
Watch some of their stuff, get familiar, and then we're going to be talking to them next week. This has been NoCo Cinema on WGN Plus. We are your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago and all around the world. Good morning, good afternoon, and good night. Night.